Good afternoon and welcome everybody to the Minnesota House of Representatives Transportation Finance and Policy Committee for this Tuesday, January 26th. My name is Frank Hornstein. I'm the chair of the committee. And we have a very good and exciting meeting planned for today, where we'll be talking about transportation as a tool for economic recovery. And we have a lot of speakers today, so we'll be making sure that all of our speakers stick to the time limits that that we discussed previously, so that the committee can ask questions and we can get everybody in. This is a very, very important topic. I think it's one that really frames our discussion this year more than in past years, when we've discussed the economic development and jobs potential of transportation and in infrastructure investments. And so with that, I just wanted to, we have a couple of quick items of business and an announcement. So as we traditionally do, we will have the call of the roll. Members, just simply say present when your name is called. Mr. Dodge.
Chair Hornstein.
Present.
Vice Chair Cagle.
Present.
Representative Petersburg.
Present.
Representative Barr.
Present.
Representative Bernardi?
Present.
Representative Elkins?
Present.
Representative Frederick?
Present.
Representative Hausman?
Present.
Representative Heinrich?
Present.
Representative Kosnick? Representative Kosnick? Representative Mason?
Present.
Representative Murphy?
Murphy present.
Representative Nelson?
Present.
Representative Olson?
Present.
Representative Richardson?
Present.
Representative Torkelson?
Present.
Representative West.
Here.
There is a quorum.
Thank you, Mr. Dodge and members. Our next item of business is approval of our minutes from January 21st. Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move the adoption of the January 21st minutes.
Thank you, Representative Petersburg. To the motion, this is a voice vote. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 All those opposed? The motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Petersburg. So I just also wanted to let members know that we have gone through the process with our staff and the Speaker's office in terms of developing rules for the committee. They're very much consistent with what we've had in the past under both Republican and Democratic chairs. The main item, and so those are available for your review online. The main item that is most important, I think, to members is that we are keeping the 24-hour rule for amendments. And of course, Representative Petersburg and I now we have a regular meeting, biweekly meeting. We discuss a lot of issues, both related to process in the committee and issues of concern that members have. So, you know, if there's anything that comes up, please let one of us know and we'll raise that. But, you know, at this point, it's really kind of business as usual in terms of committee rules and procedures. And again, the 24-hour rule can be waived at my discretion, but I would do that in consultation with Representative Petersburg, as we've always done in the past on a bipartisan basis. So with that, we are going to go right into our topic for today. And I just want to preface this by saying that, you know, whether one believes in the various, we have different kinds of financing mechanisms for roads, bridge, and public transit. No matter what your viewpoint may be on that, I think it's going to be very important this year to look at how we, where we get the best bang for our buck. In terms of public transportation dollars. And so our next two speakers are actually coming to us from Washington. That is one of the advantages we have with a Zoom meeting, and we might not be able to hear from them otherwise. And so I'm really appreciative of them and their time. And I will introduce our first guest. Her name is Beth Osborne. Ms. Osborne is the Director of Transportation for America. She was previously at the U.S. Department of Transportation, where she served as the Acting Assistant Secretary for Transportation Policy and the Deputy Assistant Secretary for Transportation Policy. So, Ms. Osborne, we are very, very happy that you could make it here, and welcome to the Minnesota House of Representatives. Please state your name for our public record, and then proceed.
Thank you, Chairman Horstein, and all of the members of the committee for inviting me today. My name is Beth Osborne, and I am the Director of Transportation for America, a national nonprofit dedicated to creating a transportation system connecting people to jobs and essential services by all modes of travel, no matter their financial means or physical abilities. Today, I've been invited to address how transportation investments can support the economy, and want to start by just pointing out that they do so in three different ways. One is creating construction jobs through the building and improvement and repair of transportation assets. Two is by investing in existing communities by keeping infrastructure operating and in a good state of repair. And three, by connecting people to jobs, essential services, and economic opportunity, drivers and non-drivers alike. Too often we focus on the first item without enough focus on the other two areas. When I was at the U.S. Department of Transportation during the implementation of the 2009 Recovery Act, we spent a lot of time discussing how many jobs to project would be created per dollar spent on infrastructure. That number was based on jobs created by money spent on capital projects and the multiplier effect from those jobs, but that approach is myopic. The money spent on each phase of a project, from scoping to right-of-way acquisition to construction, generates a different number of jobs and a different type of job in each category. Additionally, the type of project itself changes the number of jobs created per dollar. In 2011, my current organization, while I was still at USDOT, worked with the University of Utah's Metropolitan Research Center to best understand the economic impacts of transportation spending from the 2009 Recovery Act. The next panel will dive more deeply into the types of projects that create the most immediate jobs, but the top line finding is that transit and roadway state of repair projects created more jobs per dollar. I want to spend my time today focusing on longer-term economic benefits from transportation investment. After all, we could create short-term jobs by digging holes and filling them back in, but we do this work to create the long-term economic vitality that those investments can bring. And there are two particular findings from the report we did with the University of Utah that address longer-term impacts. One is fixing existing infrastructure produces a high rate of return on investment because it's cheaper to keep assets up to a state of repair rather than having to reconstruct poorly maintained assets, and because it keeps existing communities vibrant. The second point is the best transportation investments are the ones that improve connections between people's homes and regional centers where jobs and essential services are located. And while we know about the benefits and the importance of repairing crumbling roads and bridges, we talk about it all the time, there are many pressures that make these projects challenging. In our 2019 report that we did with Taxpayers for Common Sense called Repaired Priorities, we found that addressing repair is more than a money problem, it's a priorities problem. The latest available data show that states spend as much on building new or expanding roadways as they do repairing existing ones. Minnesota does slightly better than the average, spending about 28% on expansion and 31% on repair. Every new lane mile of road costs approximately $24,000 per year to preserve in a state of good repair. By expanding roads, especially when we have neither a plan to maintain the new asset nor the ability to maintain what we've already built, we are borrowing against the future and digging a deeper hole. Now, many point out that we have more than just repair needs to address in transportation, and that is most certainly true. I know homeowners feel this push and pull all the time. In my own home, as my kids are growing up, I can't help but think it would be nice to have a second full bath. I do not look forward to sharing one bathroom with two teenagers. However, we face the fact that our roof is quite old and needs to be replaced as well. So we made the choice to replace that roof. I could have hoped the roof would hold out and invest in the daily time savings of not having to wait for my bathroom or having to change the time of my shower to off-peak hours. But I made the responsible choice, the kind of hard choice we should be making in transportation, especially transportation programs with limited funds. In transportation, that teenager using the bathroom and wasting your time is called traffic congestion. We have spent decades pouring funds into highway expansions trying to reduce congestion, only to get more of it. Across the country, we have added over 30,000 new freeway lane miles to the largest 100 urbanized areas between 1993 and 2017 alone, an increase of 42%. That rate of road expansion significantly outstripped the 32% population growth in those regions. However, traffic congestion eclipsed them both, increasing a whopping 144%. In Minneapolis, St. Paul, population growth and freeway expansion have grown at about the same rate, 35% and 34% respectively. And that investment has resulted in an increase in traffic congestion of way more than 34 or 35%. It grew at 168%. Now, Columbus, Ohio, an area of similar size, did not keep up with population growth. Population grew at 52%, freeways expanded at a much lower 34%, and yet congestion grew at about the same rate it did in the Twin Cities, 167%. Fresno, California, another area of similar size, chose a different approach. They expanded freeways at twice the rate of population growth. Population grew by 40%, freeways grew by 90%, and congestion, well, it grew much faster than Twin Cities, or a little faster than the Twin Cities or Columbus, at 171%. Three different approaches and all produce the same result. All of these funds have been spent to save time, but no time has been saved, not just because the congestion increased, but because these expansions have pushed growth to the fringes, undermined existing areas and businesses, converted a lot of rural areas to urban, and lengthened trips. In the 1950s, when we created the existing congestion measure, it was hard to predict these outcomes. We measured what we could, vehicle speeds along certain stretches of roadways, assuming that when traffic sped up, trips would take less time. We did not even try to measure how these improvements might cut off or lengthen trips for drivers trying to cross the corridor, much less people who might not be in a car at all. We also do not look at how development changes interacted with transportation investments, often in ways that lengthen trips. But today, thanks to not so new technologies like GIS and leadership from the University of Minnesota's Accessibility Observatory, we can measure these things. And in doing so, we can see the transportation trade-offs and we can better predict the results we have seen from transportation investments over the last several decades. We can measure everyone's travel as opposed to only vehicle trips. We can see how modest improvements in operations or repair projects or by clustering development near to where people live can have a bigger impact in helping people reach necessities and how much money it saves them when we do so. Using the tool your own flagship university has pioneered can give you the best information about that third area of economic benefit I mentioned, access to jobs, essential services, and economic opportunity. In my personal opinion, this is the most valuable economic benefit of transportation investment, and in fact, is the most fundamental reason to have a transportation system. This should be the primary measure of success and the priority when considering the economic impacts of transportation investment. As you all tackle the difficult challenge that leaders are grappling with across the country, how to pay for transportation needs, I'm reminded of something that Bob Corker, the former senator from Tennessee, said a few years ago. If something is a priority, you pay for it. If you aren't willing to pay for it, then it isn't a priority. And while it is never easy to come up with new funding, the areas that have had the most success in doing so start with setting a vision and goals around real regional priorities, whether that be replacing all structurally deficient bridges or guaranteeing non-drivers have access to at least half as many jobs as drivers have. While many of the transportation funding debates stay caught in a conversation about where to find money to get through a current list of projects, starting with priorities and the projects that achieve them is the most compelling approach to convincing taxpayers to invest. And setting those priorities around the investments that bring the most long-term economic benefit is a very compelling argument indeed. Thank you again for inviting me here today, and I look forward to answering your questions.
Thank you very much, Ms. Osborne. And what we're going to do is have Mr. Ellis for 10 minutes, and then we'll have a 15-minute question and answer period, and then we'll go on to our second panel. We like to break up our speakers and kind of group them by topics, so we have you and Mr. Ellis together. I am so happy that Steve Ellis can join our committee today. Mr. Ellis is the president of Taxpayers for Common Sense, which is a Washington, D.C. based policy organization. He has been with the organization since 1999 and has a wealth of information to share with us. Mr. Ellis, thank you so much. Welcome to the House of Representatives here in Minnesota, our Transportation Committee, and please state your name for our record.
Sure. Good morning, Chair Hornstein. I'm Stephen Ellis, and I'm the president of Taxpayers for Common Sense, and thank you and the members of the committee for having me. I'm very happy to talk with you today. Taxpayers for Common Sense is a national nonpartisan budget watchdog, and as Beth indicated, we released the Repair Priorities Report with Transportation for America. So not surprisingly, much of what I have to say underscores what my longtime friend and colleague Beth Osborne just said. So I'll be relatively brief. I'll give you back some of your 10 minutes. However, we approach this issue at Taxpayers for Common Sense and other issues from defense to agriculture spending on getting the most for the federal taxpayer. This is important because the majority investor in virtually any infrastructure project is the federal taxpayer. But in most cases, the federal and state taxpayers' interests align, at least on getting the most critical, highest priority projects done. People think budgets are about numbers. They're not. They're about priorities, and the numbers help tell you what is prioritized. And so Senator Corker's observation, a former mayor as well, is very apt, the one that Beth just shared. This hearing is well-timed. After years of Infrastructure Week becoming a punchline, there are real interests in moving ahead with infrastructure investments. The one-year extension of the ironically named Surface Transportation Bill expires later this year. I say ironically because the FAST Act acronym coincidentally stands for Fixing America's Surface Transportation. But as our report points out, there is still a lot to fix. The underlying theme of our report is that we as a nation are spending too much on new lane miles and not enough on repair and maintenance. And as Beth indicated, Minnesota is neither the best nor the worst in this, but this does require a national response. The pending expiration of the FAST Act is an opportunity to really fix our nation's transportation system. Our report lays out a few common sense recommendations. They are about accountability and transparency. Demand measurable outcomes for the American taxpayers. A huge amount of funding for the transportation system is coming not from the gas tax, but from the general treasury. I'll have more to say on that later. But the goals of the next six-year transportation bill should be to repair all roads in poor condition, or at least set that as a target and tie federal funds to states to accomplish that goal. Furthermore, require that states prioritize repair before expansion. No funds should go to expansion when there are unmet needs for repair. These are federal dollars. I have no problem attaching strings to them if it leads to less spending in the future. It costs more to take, and this is also indicated by Beth, it takes more to take a road from poor to good or even fair than it does to maintain it at good condition. Furthermore, we should require sponsors to prove that they can maintain new roadway projects. Sadly, today's new roadway capacity project has the possibility or even probability of being tomorrow's backlog. In other words, if you can't take care of what you have, you shouldn't be adding to the system. And finally, transparency and accountability at FHWA. States are required to set performance targets for the highway conditions and report them to the Federal Highway Administration. This information, coupled with the actual road conditions, must be better communicated and up to date. Taxpayers deserve to know where their dollars are going and what they are achieving or not. These are the joint recommendations we had in repair priorities. And Taxpayers for Common Sense was very pleased to be able to join with Transportation for America on this latest iteration of the report. There are a few other items that I would like to tackle, strictly speaking, for Taxpayers for Common Sense. The financing system for the Highway Trust Fund is in shambles. When he was arguing to take the Highway Trust Fund off budget to protect it from being raided for other purposes, then House Transportation and Infrastructure Chair Bud Schuster pledged that the Highway Trust Fund would never take money from the General Treasury. Then he retired. Since 2008, more than $150 billion has been taken from the General Treasury coffers to cover Highway Trust Fund shortfalls from expected spending levels. The gas tax hasn't been adjusted since 1983. And between fuel efficiency and construction costs exceeding inflation, its purchasing power has been diminished. But the appetite for spending has not been satiated. Shifts to electric vehicles will further erode it as a funding mechanism. Bottom line, revenue should meet spending. So there needs to be innovation. For instance, the state of Oregon has adopted a voluntary vehicle miles traveled tax as an alternative. One option that comes up as infrastructure circles is PPPs, public-private partnerships. We all know the old adage that if something looks too good to be true, it probably is. PPPs have to be structured extremely well to protect the taxpayer. For a PPP to succeed, there has to be a steady profit stream to pay off initial costs. Furthermore, virtually no private entity is going to have a cheaper borrowing cost than a public one. The profits are privatized and the risks are socialized. We've seen all too often that the private company folds and taxpayers are left holding the bag. These are big challenges facing the nation in Minnesota. It is critical that the nation's infrastructure investments are prioritized, responsible, and worthwhile. Again, thank you very much for inviting me to talk with you today, and I'm happy to take any questions you might have.
Thank you so much, Mr. Ellis and Ms. Osborne. We do have questions, and our first question is from Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and this one is for Ms. Osborne in regards to congestion. It's one of the things that I've been hearing as one of the categories in which we kind of refer on the need for transportation infrastructure has to do with congestion. And yet I have this general feeling that I've had for a long time, being that I've driven up here in the cities for almost 60 years now, 50 years anyway, that congestion is kind of like water. It always kind of meets and flattens out, and it always kind of equalizes. And so it was very curious for you to say that it didn't matter if you built roads faster or not, congestion kind of stayed the same, which kind of indicates to me that people will, whenever there's an improvement, they'll move farther away until the congestion gets so far that they don't want to deal with that congestion anymore, and then they'll stop the expansion. But can you explore more on whether or not we ought to be still using congestion as one of our factors for determining transportation needs?
Oh, we could spend so much time discussing this. I think I always go back to something one of my past bosses once said to me, which is people have a tolerance for a certain average trip, particularly to work. It's someplace between 30 and 45 miles per hour. If you make it faster, they'll make it longer, or they'll be satisfied with it being longer. We also have seen the footprint of cities grow to an extreme amount when you take into account the metropolitan area. So one of the things we've seen consistently happen is trips grow longer as we make travel faster. So yeah, we're seeing that we just overload the system. We also, as we spread out where people live and where all their needs are, we require more trips per person to accomplish their daily needs. So it's a very effective way to create more traffic congestion with fewer people, an incredible inefficiency. And I think a lot of it comes down to the fact that we just simply have not modernized our measurement standards. The folks in the 1950s that set travel speed as congestion measure were doing the best with what information they had access to at the time. And it was a smart proxy because it was the closest they could get. But in today's world, we have so much more measurement capacity, starting with the fact that we're not just looking at your average speed on your trip without regard to whether you arrive at all. I mean, right now, the way we measure congestion, if you travel in circle at speeds, that's an A-plus system. But if you travel slowly for 10 minutes and arrive, that's a failure. It's wildly out of step with the experience that the traveler has. And so I think it's time after 70 years to just use modern technology to measure the user's experience and determine whether the biggest problem we have is that traffic is moving slowly on short trips, or whether or not people might just need some of the things they need to be a little closer to their home, rather than whether or not on some segment of their trip, the travel is slower.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Petersburg, for that question. Representative Cagle, you're next, our vice chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I think this question might be for Ms. Osborne as well. Are there any metro areas that have invested in land planning and transit versus building more highways or roads? And if so, what was the congestion impact for those communities?
You ask an excellent question, and I will tell you that when we did our measurement of the past 25 years of congestion trends, a report we wrote called Congestion Con, we really struggled to find a single cause, or I was really looking for a through line in the story, and really everything was all over the place. My guess is the thing that is most impacting congestion is the fact that the footprint of the community has grown even when the population has shrunk. So we're seeing massive increases in congestion in areas that have lost population and added highway miles. And that really can only be explained by the idea that people have to travel further, they're more spread out, and that they have to take more trips to accomplish basic needs. So my guess is the best solution is a development solution. And my unfortunate answer is no. I don't think any place in the United States has done a very good job of addressing this. We are starting to see areas focus more on this, but because of the regional effect of travel and job sheds, it really requires a regional approach to it. And so far what I'm seeing is jurisdiction by jurisdiction approach. And so while you might see a particular community, maybe in the suburbs or the core city, try something, we're not seeing the whole region take it on.
Do you have a follow-up, Representative Cagle? Okay, I'm not seeing any more questions. I guess I will conclude with one, and it would be either for Ms. Osborne or Mr. Ellis, and that is, either at the federal or state level, are either of you aware of states or, again, within the federal transportation system, policies that have actually been in place that have prioritized what you're talking about, you know, maintenance and efficiency? Have you seen, or at least efficiency through maintenance, have you seen anything that would direct transportation agencies at any level of government to prioritize the investments, the kinds of investments you were talking about? And I see Mr. Ellis is ready to go here.
Yeah, thank you very much, Chair. You know, that's one of the things that we actually call for in the Repair Priorities Report is that the federal government should, in their next surface transportation reauthorization, actually, and this may not be popular talking to a state legislature, but essentially tie strings to the funds that they need to be directed towards repair. So basically pushing states and localities in that actual direction, and that also setting targets for where the road conditions are so that, you know, the money leads the states and localities to the right answer. It's not that I necessarily like a top-down approach, but I also recognize that a huge amount of money is coming from not just the gas tax that's going back to the states, but coming from the federal taxpayer out of the general treasury. And so that we have a right to demand, you know, excellence and better performance for those tax dollars.
I will add that Massachusetts was our top ranking state in terms of focusing on state of repair. They only had about 4% of their funds going to expansion. The real conversion story was the state of Mississippi. One of their commissioners who had been the former head of the Senate had presided when he was in the Senate over a policy to require new highways in every single county of their state. And then when he became a transportation commissioner, he realized the incredible cost burden that was putting on future generations. And they changed the policy to a state of repair first policy, reversing their spending from 74% expansion as of 2015 to really 74% repair by 2019. So that was a really impressive thing to see there. I will also add that a bunch of states have made other changes that help to address some of these issues. The state of California has created a calculator to measure induced demand. The idea that when you expand a highway, people might add trips or they might shift their trips into your new corridor, clogging it back up. This is something that was first recognized back the year I was born, which was a long time ago, and has never been properly measured or recognized. And now the state of California has a calculator to help their engineers and their localities to do that. And then finally, I will mention that access has become a primary measure of new capacity projects, access to jobs and access to essential services in the state of Virginia, but also the state of Utah has adopted that. And while they're further behind in the implementation than Virginia is, their legislature acted to require that as a measure of projects going forward, all of which add up to more of a focus on repair.
Well, thank you very much. I'm just going to scan one more time to see if we have any questions. I don't see any. And I just want to thank you, Ms. Osborne and Mr. Ellis, so much for spending some time with us. We will make your report available on our reports, actually available on our committee website. And I think that your perspective and help is not only appreciated, but I think will help guide us as we move forward. We're putting together a comprehensive transportation finance bill. We do it every biennium. So we'll be doing that in March and April, and we'll be debated in the floor of the legislature, you know, later on in spring. So we appreciate so much your time and all of your work, and thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Jerome.
Thank you, members. So we have our second panel for the day, and we're going to hear from first from Jody Tyke. You may know her as the leader of the Minnesota Transportation Alliance, but she also works as the Stearns County engineer. And Ms. Tyke, I know you have some testimony and a video. I don't know if you want to do the video first or testify, but either way, I think we're set up for you. So welcome to the committee, Ms. Tyke. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you. Again, my name is Jody Tyke. I am the Stearns County engineer and the president of the Minnesota Transportation Alliance. Again, thank you, Chair Hornstein and members of the committee. It's my honor to be in front of you today. And my main point, I guess, is the legislature works this session to focus on how the state can speed recovery from the COVID-19 pandemic. The members of the Minnesota Transportation Alliance want to stress the importance of infrastructure investments to maintain and improve publicly owned assets while also creating jobs and spurring badly needed economic activity. Investments in transportation infrastructure pay for themselves in increased economic activity and tax revenue. For every dollar invested, there's an economic return of approximately $2.40. Construction projects not only create jobs in engineering and construction, they indirectly create jobs in all sectors of the economy as workers spend the money that they earn. As an example, an increase of $600 million per year in highway and bridge investments would create, sustain an additional 12,238 jobs throughout the state's economy, with a total annual payroll of about $455 million. This level of investment would generate and sustain an additional $86.8 million in tax revenues, including $5.5 million in state payroll tax collection.
Is this my computer or Ms. Tyke's? Do we have a...
Hers.
I think it's hers, Frank. It's because mine's froze up. Hers okay. Froze up.
An engineering firm needs stable and dependable funding to maintain their business and to retain their employees. Last spring, as things were beginning to shut down due to COVID restrictions, as a county engineer, I received many calls from Stearns County area contractors, as well as consultants and suppliers across the state with one key question. Will you be moving forward with your existing road improvement program? I can say honestly that many were grateful that I said with certainty that 2020, the answer was yes. And I was not the only county engineer to receive those calls. Adjustments in constitutionally dedicated user fees provide the kind of stable, dependable funding the transportation industry needs in order to plan for future staff and equipment needs and to remain profitable and retain those quality employees. Economists have long recognized the important role of infrastructure investments during economic downturns, and that's why we're hearing more discussion even at the federal level about the importance of a major infrastructure investment package as the federal government is trying to assist with economic recovery from the pandemic. Further, roads that are full of potholes and that are beyond their design life can also pose safety hazards. I know we just heard about congestion, but congestion does cost shippers and all drivers real money in terms of lost time and wasted fuel. Deterioration of the infrastructure directly impacts the bottom line of manufacturers, farmers, and other shippers. When bridges are posted with lower weight limits because of structural deficiencies, trucks and other agricultural equipment have to find longer, and in some cases much longer, detours around those bridges, which adds to their daily costs. I'm going to pause for a moment to show a very brief video. I promise you, I know you're on a timeline. And this video features just one Stearns County bridge. So bear with me while I share the screen. Let's see here. And unless I hear otherwise, I'm going to assume you all can see and hear everything. Yeah.
I'm Brian Klemke, I'm from Stearns County, and I'm a bridge inspector. As a bridge inspector, we look at the concrete, look at the cracks, look at the corrosion. We have severe corrosion going on the rebar, which holds this bridge in place. And a lot of that you can hear from a solid to a hollowness like that. You've lost a lot of strength in your bridge on the underside. It's all about safety. We all want to go home and see our kids. It gets very frustrating when you can come down here. Anybody can walk down here and see the shape of this bridge that it's in. And the main reason this is happening is these bridges aren't getting replaced as soon as they should just due to funding. We definitely need the funding. Once it starts, it don't stop until it's over. It's troublesome.
All right, thank you for humoring me with that. That is actually a real Stearns County bridge. It's just east of the city of Melrose.
So, first of all,
one moment, sorry.
Oh, go ahead.
So, in conclusion, many of the facts and figures I've shared with you today can be found in a report summarized and researched by a team led by ARTBA, or the American Road and Transportation Builders Association in Washington, D.C. I believe there's a link on your committee page. The Transportation Alliance urges your support for the resources needed to address deficient bridges, repair, and improve our state and local roadways, and provide improved bus facilities to get Minnesota's economy moving again. And I will be available at the end of this section if anybody has any questions. Thank you again.
Thank you so much, Ms. Tyke, and thank you for your work and your service. I always want to thank our public sector employees. And then we have two more speakers for this particular panel, and then we'll take some questions and answers. And they'll be short presentations, 5 minutes each. And I'm very happy to welcome to the committee Mr. John Thorson. And I don't know, Mr. Thorson, is Mr. Norden with you as well?
Yes, he is.
Okay, so we will have Mr. John Thorson and Mr. John Norden from the Laborers International Union, who have been very strong partners in transportation. And we welcome you to the committee. Mr. Thorson, please state your name for the record.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is John Thorson. I'm legislative director for LIUNA Minnesota, North Dakota. We're Minnesota's infrastructure union, representing more than 12,000 skilled construction laborers, who, along with our brothers and sisters in the construction and building trades, maintain and build our state's roads, highways, bridges, and transit-related developments. COVID-19 has sparked a national recession and has left many Minnesotans reeling. It's disproportionately affected communities of color and people in greater Minnesota. And it has been particularly hard on the construction industry, with many projects either being delayed, scaled back, or canceled altogether in response to the pandemic. Three points. One, there is a roadmap before you, Mr. Chair, members of this committee, for both employing construction workers who've been displaced by the pandemic and moving our economy forward through critical investments in transportation infrastructure. The Mr. Chair, you've done it before, the last recession. coming out of it. It was decisions for swift state action paired with smart investments to minimize the impacts of job loss and economic harm. These investments created pathways of opportunity for both unemployed construction workers and for new entrants into the industry as well. It was those decisions back in 2009 that led Minnesotans to a faster and more robust recovery than our neighbors to the east in Wisconsin, who instead chose a path of austerity and tax cuts. According to our research, every $1 billion in road and bridge spending creates an estimated 7.5 to 11.3 million hours of construction work, or 5,000 to 7,500 job years, assuming that workers in the construction field work 1,500 hours per year. Two of these investments for repairing and maintenance of existing assets can both spend money faster and create jobs more quickly than newer projects because they employ more kinds of workers. They spend less money on land, put more money into wages, and spend less time on plans and permits. And these are good jobs. The socioeconomic impacts of family supporting jobs, providing comprehensive health care and retirement benefits that offer opportunities for lifelong training and career advancement, can exceed those by a relatively low wage, no benefit job by a factor of five or more. There are thousands of individuals that right now await participation in registered apprenticeship programs. Our state's construction industry relies on these programs to produce a skilled, safe, and efficient trades workforce. These programs are critical to efforts in increasing participation of women, people of color, veterans, and other underrepresented groups in this workforce. And public investments that can be made by this committee this year in roads, bridges, transit, and their asset preservation can keep building trades members working safely in 2021 and beyond. I have one such member today. John Nordine is with me. He's a member of LIUNA Local 563. He's been employed in the construction industry since 1994 and is eagerly awaiting the investments that we've been talking about today.
Thank you very much, Mr. Thorson. Thank you, Mr. Nordine, for your time and coming to the committee. Please state your name for our official record.
Good afternoon. My name is John Nordine. Good afternoon, Chair Horstein, Vice Chair Cagle, and committee members. My name is John Nordine III, grandson of former State Representative John H. Nordine. I live with my wife and daughter in Blaine, Minnesota. I've been a proud member of the Labor's Union, LIUNA, for 26 years. I'm thankful to have enjoyed a very strong and wonderful career in construction, which has allowed me to provide for my family and give them great health care and a great life. The Labors also have an excellent pension, and I'm very much look forward to retiring with dignity when I leave the field in 2 years. But this wasn't the dream job and life I initially had in mind. After high school, I went to college for building guitars and making music. I loved the arts and wanted to pursue a career in music, but it didn't work out. I left school after a few years with more than $36,000 in student debt and no job. Luckily, I got a job working on asbestos removal and started earning money as I was building my career. I was a young man working hard, earning good money. I gained countless skills and experiences that would carry me throughout my career. Right now, I work on Centennial Parking Ramp near the Capitol, a project that is component of our transportation infrastructure. Patching and upgrading the ramp keeps the facility nice, safe, and functioning. This kind of ongoing maintenance across the transportation system requires serious long-term public investment. To date, Minnesota faces $18 billion funding gap over the next 20 years just to maintain our current system. Lawmakers have a duty to keep our roads, bridges, and transit systems safe so nothing like the 35W bridge collapse ever happens again. By investing in dedicated comprehensive transportation funding, You will help fix our crumbling roads, bridges across the state, and thousands of good union construction jobs. My brothers and sisters in the industry are hurting and facing a lot of uncertainty as the recession has slowed down projects. Comprehensive transportation funding will provide a much needed boost to help keep trade workers employed and create new opportunities for young people to start a career in construction. Thank you for your time.
Thank you so much, Mr. Nordine. Thank you for your work and your testimony. And we will have questions and answers after our last speaker for this particular panel. And that is Ms. Laura Ziegler. And she is with the Associated General Contractors of Minnesota. Welcome to the committee, Ms. Ziegler. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good afternoon, and to all the members of the committee. My name is Laura Ziegler. I'm with Associated General Contractors in Minnesota. You've heard a lot of helpful and important information and stories today. I'm honored to work with my fellow panelists that you've heard from, and also pleased to represent the private sector for today's discussion. AGC is a statewide trade association. Our mission is to promote the health and sustainability of Minnesota's construction industry through leadership and advocacy. We have over 400 members throughout the state. They represent both horizontal construction as well as the vertical commercial market. The majority of our membership chooses to be signatory to various unions. And for today's discussion, I wanted to focus a little bit more on those horizontal members of ours. Often referred to as highway heavy contractors, but they don't just build roads, but all of our infrastructure that we use every day. In addition to building highways, roads, bridges, they create the infrastructure for sewer, water, broadband, other utilities, parks, trails, airports, walkways, energy, and transit systems. Many aspects that you as members of this committee will consider investments in this year. Many of you know these contractors and employers in your community. And as Ms. Tyke mentioned, our contractors work with all public owners, the state level, counties, and cities. We talk about jobs a lot in the construction industry and job creation. What's also important to note is that this is an investment in careers. These, as it was previously mentioned, these are good paying careers. And having sustained long-term funding gives businesses the opportunity to plan for their own investment, because we know that Minnesota has a predictable funding stream for work. For example, a business may decide to buy heavy equipment versus renting, because that makes business sense for them, or that use of it, that piece of equipment. It's very easy to see how quickly this can have a ripple effect, and it can affect suppliers, manufacturers, implements, and various other industries. As Mr. Thorson mentioned, having sustained work helps with recruitment and retention in the trades as well. And finally, you've heard multiple times today, perhaps this is helpful for our adult learning to hear it again, but your investment in infrastructure, it does get a great return on investment. Our National Association, AGC of America, partnered with the University of Colorado last year to develop a very helpful resource called the Construction Impact Model. So we do have the ability to calculate the total economic impact, those direct and indirect jobs, as well as the induced effect that it has on the state. We can do this for construction, for non-residential structures, multifamily structures, repair and maintenance of highways, roads, and bridges, et cetera. So if we take the $300 million transportation investment in the bonding bill last year, we know that that has a total economic impact of over $594 million. And this includes direct, indirect, supplier, and other induced spending jobs. So please let me know if any of you in the future are interested in utilizing this information. I'd be happy to help provide that. Mr. Chair, thanks for your time and the other members, and also for your commitment to economic recovery. And we're here as a resource as you continue the discussion.
Thank you very much, Ms. Ziegler. And that tool that you were describing sounds fascinating. Maybe there is a way for for us to be able to share it with the committee. And I'll just start off the question with the questions with a question on that. Can this tool be used on a project by project basis, or is it sort of you talked about the bonding bill as a whole, but can we really look at the economic impact of an individual project through that tool?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, for the question. It would be somewhat limited to the overall estimate of the price tag of the particular project, but I think we'd have some ability to be able to provide some range within that. The tool is a little bit more general in terms of larger investments. So in terms of $100 million investment for a program, that might be more suitable for the use of this type of model.
Thank you very much, Ms. Ziegler. Are there any other questions from the committee for this particular panel? Okay, I don't see any, but I do very much appreciate you are all three or four of you really on the front lines of transportation and, both maintaining and building and contracting for these projects. And we appreciated so much your work. And again, I think your message to us about the return on the dollar and Mr. Nordin, I think especially you putting a very personal touch on this and how this has just helped you and your family to grow and thrive. And we want transportation investments to help many families grow and thrive. And Mr. Thorson, again, I think your mention of equity is very, very important. I think it's going to be critical to look at all of this through an equity lens. We're going to be getting into that, as our session advances. So thank you very much to this panel. And we have several more speakers with us. And I'll first introduce Will Schroer from East Metro Strong. And Will describe East Metro Strong, but it is, several different chambers of commerce, business organizations. And Will will be talking about some of the work that he's doing. He is the executive director of East Metro Strong, also has some important studies and data and perspectives to share with us. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Schroer. Please state your name for the record. And unmute first.
And there we go.
There we go. Thank you.
And there we go. Thank you, Chair Hornstein and members of the committee. And we'll all get good at this just as we all become vaccinated. At least that's right. Thank you for having me here today, and I want to thank the folks who went ahead of me as well, and I share your appreciation, Mr. Chair, for their insight, and I hope that I can add to it.
And Mr. Chair, you're breaking up just a tad. I don't know if there's a way to adjust the microphone, but I wanted to give you a heads up on that.
I appreciate that. I'm going to go ahead and share my screen, and I've enjoyed a little break, actually, from a lot of PowerPoints, but I wanted to share a couple of things on paper with the committee here today. Do I sound better?
Yeah, Mr. much better. Very clear. Very good. Very good.
All right. Very, very good. Thank you very much. Well, let's dive in. So you've heard from a number of the other witnesses today. Oh, I'm sorry. I didn't share my name for the record. I don't believe that. Will Schroer, Executive Director, East Metro Strong. And as the chair said, we are a public-private partnership, not only between chambers of commerce and employers, but also several of the municipalities and counties on the east side of the metro. Genuine public-private partnership, and I'm proud to be part of it. So you have heard from a couple of the other speakers about, and most recently from Mr. Thorson, that not all projects are created equal. And we're not here to, my goal today is not to judge which ones are more valuable in terms of providing access or anything else, as Beth mentioned, but simply what do we know about their job production impacts. And as Mr. Thorson said, sometimes repair jobs can go more quickly, they can provide more and different kinds of jobs. And I just want to pick up on some of those observations with some hard numbers from previous experience. So we can go about this in a couple of ways. We can use large models. We can use project level models, as we just heard about from the prior speaker. Overall, the large national models that, and when we use the word model, sometimes we think of just, you know, people experimenting on a computer. No, these take the actual statistics of project costs and who's employed and how they're employed and run them through input output and downstream effects, et cetera. And what we find is that in general, transit produces roughly 31% more jobs per dollar than does new road construction. And that repair produces roughly 16% more jobs than new roads. And you heard some of the reasons for those previously. The new road construction requires buying the land that produces jobs for lawyers in a lot of cases. A lot of lawyers and big fans of them, but generally don't find have trouble finding jobs. If we want to put folks to work building things, then we want to save money on land and put it into other projects, and road repair and transit tends to do that. We also know, just again, as Mr. Thorson said, it's the diversity of jobs that produces some of these numbers as well. The other way we can go about it is to look at what one might call, for lack of a better term, experiments in the past. And as Beth Osborne mentioned, the last time that we had a large federal stimulus, the Department of Transportation required recipients to track how those dollars were spent, including the number of jobs that were created with those federal dollars. And so we have a great data set that allows us to ask, okay, when the feds send money, what specific job impacts do those have? Don't run it through a model that might, you know, produce misleading results one way or the other. What actually happened? And the results were very much in line, actually, with what the large national models show, that public transit produces far more job hours. The number that came out of the last federal stimulus was about 70% more jobs from a transit dollar than from a new road construction project. And we could talk about why that was so much higher than what the models predict, but that's what the states reported. And then the dollar that's spent on road repair produced roughly what the large national models predicted in above a new road construction project. We also know from those statistics how Minnesota spent its last transportation stimulus dollars. And Minnesota spent the least in the category that produced the most jobs. They spent the least portion of their money. I should say we, since I'm a Minnesotan, we chose to spend the least number of dollars on transit investment, which produces the most jobs per dollar. I believe we've been over this a couple of times, so I'll just save the committee's time. And I want to lift up, because I think it hasn't been touched on by previous speakers, where some of the manufacturing jobs in particularly the transit industry go. We heard about the construction jobs and those, many of those obviously go to Minnesotans, and that's fantastic. East Metro Strong partnered with the Minneapolis Regional Chamber of Commerce last year to look at where transit assembly and manufacturing jobs in Minnesota. And we found a surprising, I have to admit, number of transit manufacturing jobs in Minnesota, most of which are in places with not particularly great transit. I don't know if that's ironic or not, but there it is. So the woman on the top left of the screen is building a New Flyer bus in St. Cloud. New Flyer, literally one of the world's leading manufacturers of large transit buses. And we have a lot of New Flyer buses being used here in Minnesota. In the lower right, those are folks working at Waldock in Forest Lake, and they make a lot of the smaller vehicles, which are used in particularly in rural transit services. And when you map the location of all these different industries, you can see that of, so we counted 60 of any size in Minnesota. And if you peer closely at your screen, as I'm doing, four.
Mr. Shore, are you you're promoted for a second.
Minneapolis and St. Paul.
Okay, good.
So there we go. Okay. It's telling me my internet is unstable.
You froze for a...
Can you hear me now, Frank?
Yes, yeah. You were frozen just for a few seconds when you first started describing the map.
Very good. So if you peer at the screen as I'm doing now, you can count four transit manufacturing industries in Minneapolis and St. Paul proper. And all of the others are either in the greater region or in the state, greater Minnesota overall. I had the privilege of visiting the plant in Bloomington, Thermo King, which makes, they invented the bus air conditioner, and now makes a great, is a world leader in bus and transit vehicle air conditioning. And they work closely with New Flyer, among others. And if anyone has an opportunity to go visit these or any other plants, it's really fascinating. And it's just a snapshot into, even if you're not served necessarily by a transit system, as a Minnesotan, you may be benefiting from transit spending. So I'd like to conclude by asking, in light of the data that we've collected both nationally and then here in Minnesota, how can we use transportation dollars to help Minnesotans succeed? Beth Osborne talked about using those dollars to connect people to jobs and to education. And I'd like to just pick up where she left off and emphasize that those opportunities exist all over Minnesota and not just in some of the larger towns. I've been working in this area for a while, and I'm always struck by the number of folks in more rural areas who tell me that they have trouble or they know someone who has trouble getting to work or to school because they don't have good transit service in their community or their county. I've had employers tell me we have trouble getting people to our shifts, that's an additional business expense that we have to take on because the public sector is important. So maybe you'll hear more about that from other speakers, but I wanted to just lift that up for the committee's consideration as well. Like the other speakers, all of the statistics that I've shared with you today are available in pretty well-documented reports, and I'd be glad to be in touch with anybody who'd like to dive in more detail. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, members of the committee.
Thank you very much, thank you, Mr. Schroer, and we will have you stick around for questions as well. We have two more speakers on this panel. I'm very excited that we have Mr. Rick Trontvedt, and he is the Senior Vice President of Human Resources at Marvin Windows in War Road. He has served in a similar capacity at other private companies that do business in greater Minnesota. And he has served as the past board chair of the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce, and that was in 2015 and 2016. So he has a very good business perspective on the role of transportation and economic recovery, and we're very pleased again to have you. Mr. Trontvedt, welcome to our committee, and please state your name for the record.
Yes, thank you for having me. My name is Rick Trontvedt, Senior Vice President of Human Resources with Marvin Companies.
And you can proceed, Mr. Trontvedt.
Yeah, well, thank you for having me on the call today on the hearing, and just wanted to just say a few words about my experience in greater Minnesota. I was with Marvin in a lead HR capacity for almost 6 years, then went to DigiKey Electronics for 17 years, and now been back here at Marvin leading HR for 2 years. And most of my career, if not all, I was in South Dakota for a small stint, but mainly I've been in northwestern Minnesota. And what I've seen here is that sometimes we have to pull ourselves up by our own bootstraps. And one of the examples of that was when I was at DigiKey. We just had a tremendous thundering growth in employment, and but unable to keep track, unable to keep up with the even bigger growth in our sales revenues for a few years. And so what we did there, and what Mr. Howe had asked me to share, was we contracted with three bus services, one that's very close and I think intertwined with the state of Minnesota funding, the Heartland Bus Company, or the Heartland Bus Organization out of Crookston, and then a couple of private charter buses out of the Bagley-Bemidji area and out of the East Grand Forks area. So what we Thief River Falls had a labor market of about 9,000 local residents and about 6,000 within 15 minutes, another few thousand within 15 minutes circumference. And so maybe a little bit under 15,000 MSA, and we really needed many more candidates than we had there in the local area. So we pushed out a number of relocation incentives when they didn't work. We just took matters into our own hands, and we basically advertised for compressed 3-12 or 4-10 hour shifts, riding the bus that we basically contracted with for free from those three labor markets that were adjoining the Thief River, or just outside of the Thief River Falls labor market, more than a 45 minute drive away. And it really was a game changer for us. We filled the three buses, and over time we were able to, I think we dissolved one of them, and I'm not sure, I've been away from that company for a couple of years. I'm not sure if they're still going or if they kind of leveled off their employment and no longer need that. But that's an example of what I talked about earlier of kind of raising yourself up by your own bootstraps in Greater Minnesota. I do like the idea that Heartland was, the state was involved there. And I think that's a cool kind of public-private cooperative thing that was done so that we were able to use some state influence there to get the Heartland bus to come our way at a good contracted price. I would also say in Warroad now, we are really, really hurting. We've got, in terms of shortage of people, we've got 150, 170 jobs open at our Warroad plant. We need really solid, dependable roads. We would love to see the potential for busing, but it's a little harder here because our busing would be from labor market that's just a little too far away because we're just a little bit more remote than Thief River Falls from adjoining labor markets. And so we're looking into other commuter ideas. We've got commuting allowances. We've got relocation incentives that are just very, very generous in the thousands of dollars. And we're still hobbling along trying to find folks to move here and work with us. We have tremendously good paying manufacturing jobs with great benefits. And so anything on the transit side, I know there's a lot of focus on light rail and some of the things in the metro, but the Greater Minnesota area has hundreds and hundreds of jobs open and vacant and waiting for good people to come and fill those jobs. And anything we can do to help with public transit. I would just say, I know there's some roads and bridges involved in this call. Keeping the roads in the Warroad area good for the Marvin truck fleet that we have here that are shipping our product all over the country, and keeping them safe with rumble strips and other precautionary things, good striping and good clear, keeping them clear in the winter for the hundreds and thousands of employees that are driving in every day remains very important to Marvin companies. And so just want to thank everybody for joining or for having me on the call today. And when it comes time for question time, I'll hang on and be willing to answer, field any questions anyone might have. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Mr. Trompet. That was very, very interesting. And I will definitely have a question for you, so I appreciate it. We have one last speaker, and then we will have a member Q&A after him. His name is Eric Saltvold, and he is from Eric's Bike, Board, and Ski. Now, members, we've been talking about transit and roads and bridges, but active transportation is also a part of a much broader, not only transportation funding package that we're going to be putting together, but it's also very, very good for the economy. And so Mr. Saltvold will talk about that experience. He is the founder and owner of Eric's Bike and Board and Ski. And many of us may know him as Eric the Bike Man. And I want to thank you, Mr. Saltwell, because I have not shared this with the committee yet, but amazingly, I did do a couple of days of the Minnesota AIDS ride a few years ago. We started in Representative Frederick's district and came back to the Twin Cities from there, or at least it was in Mankato, and then we went through Representative Frederick's district. Your company was there for to help us repair our bikes and keep us moving. So I've always appreciated that. So welcome to the committee, Mr. Saltvold, and please state your name for the record. I thought I saw him earlier. Mr. Howe, do we have Ms. Zaff after that introduction? I don't know if he had to leave.
I'm working on it, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Oh, I see him here. If anyone can dial up an Eric the Bike Man commercial, we could hear that in the meantime. No, I'm joking. Well, we will, I think while Mr. Howe is working on getting Mr. Sotvold connected or with us, I did have an initial question for Mr. Trontved, and maybe we could just do that one now.
Sure, that'd be fine.
And if other members have questions, we can get to those as well. Mr. Trontved, I had the opportunity to visit with one of our former members who passed away last year, Representative Bernie Leader, who was just a hero of transportation and a mentor of mine. We remember him fondly. I had a chance to visit him in Crookston in 2019. And he, as part of our visit, we did go to the New Flyer plant there. And then we also went to, I think it's called Tri-Valley. I'm not sure. Is that Tri-Valley Heartland that you were?
Yes, that's the affiliate that we use for our service.
And
that's
so I had a chance to visit with a number of the employees there. And we actually watched people getting onto the buses heading up to DigiKey. I think it was about a 60 mile ride. And what I learned, and you mentioned this, the incentives, I think as I recall, and correct me if I'm wrong, but as I recall, there was actually a salary supplement for taking transit. Was that correct? And that seemed very innovative, and I maybe talk about that a little bit more.
Yeah, as I recall, Chair Hornstein, we had one of the big attractive pieces of that was the 12-hour schedule or the 10-hour schedule that they were going to. So they had, you know, they were able to get Wi-Fi on the bus and basically ride the bus for 45 minutes from Crookston, roughly. The Bemidji-Bagley bus was about an hour, and so was the East Grand Forks. So getting to be more than an hour is tough, but if you do especially a 10-hour shift, you end up with a 12-hour day. That's a pretty good day. And yes, they came on to not only a good shift in terms of the lengthier shift, but they also received what we called evening pay. So they got a little bit more pay per hour for being part of that schedule. And, you know, we actually had a waiting list for in all three communities for that schedule. I think the word got out and it worked out pretty well. And the only thing is we may have, you know, it's probably good for us to use a number of providers, but, you know, had the Heartland and Tri-Valley been a little bit, had more equipment and more capabilities, perhaps we could have done a public-private partnership on all three routes, but we just chose to use that one route.
Thank you, Mr. Trontved. It is really an amazing success story, and I know that it was great to just see the employees and talk with them, and it really was a major benefit for them, and I think they enjoyed the extra the salary enhancement as well. So thank you for your work. And now we have Mr. Sotvold. Thank you so much. I did give you an introduction, and if there's anything in addition to people knowing that you're the founder and owner of Eric's Bike and Board and Ski, that would be great. But we did, as by way of introduction, talk about, you know, your business as a form of economic development and recovery in the transportation sector. And that's really our topic for today. Mr. Sotvold, thank you, and welcome to the Minnesota House of Representatives Transportation Committee. Please state your name for our record, and we are looking forward to hearing from you.
Great. My name is Eric Sotvold, and I am the founder and owner of Eric's Bike, Board, and Ski. I started in 1977 in my parents' backyard in Richfield, Minnesota. I was 13 at the time, and other than a paper route, it's the only job I've held. We've grown to be the largest independently owned bicycle retailer in the USA with 31 stores in 7 states. We employ up to 500 full-time staffers. We have stores throughout the metro area in Rochester and St. Cloud. In fact, just this past year, we relocated our headquarters to Minneapolis in a nearly 120,000 square foot distribution and office center. We're part of just a very small part of the bicycle industry that chooses to headquarter here in Minnesota. Quality Bicycle Products and Park Tool are just two other industry leaders based here. Nationally, the bike biz is an $8 billion industry. Minnesota infrastructure is a key reason for this. Warm, safer places to ride, whether for transportation or recreation, leads to more cyclists. Minnesota is recognized as a top leader in trails and rider participation per capita. When we decide to invest in a new store, access to cycling infrastructure is a key data point. This drives participation. As an example, we recently invested nearly $2 million in a new site for Eric's in Richfield due to the incredible work that's been done in that community with cycling infrastructure. More staff and more activity for this area due to the infrastructure investments. Residential real estate also benefits from cycling infrastructure as residents place a high value on this quality of life activity and access to safe routes to schools or workplaces via bike. Cycling is also driving tourism in our state, as you can see from examples in Lanesboro and Cuyuna as two really national leading examples of tourism and cycling. During this past year, this has become even more apparent as the industry has boomed during COVID. People have embraced cycling for its physical and mental health benefits, family-friendly activity, and its transportation application. Many people use the bike as a primary or secondary form of transportation. Being on bike is truly one of the great social distancing activities. Sales of bikes and related gear have zoomed over 40% for the industry during COVID, and Eric's has continued to increase our career employment and investments during these challenging economic times. And this is not a one-time event. Cycling has enjoyed strong sales for many decades, and the future looks bright. A big driver of future growth is the electric bike or e-bike. This bike has a small motor that either propels or more commonly just assists the rider by giving a boost to their pedaling. It is cycling and is powered by you, but just gives you a little push. Commuting, transportation, and recreation are all served by e-bikes, and we see the adoption rate of this product growing at over 100% year over year. As more and more people embrace it, the demand will grow for safer and dedicated cycling lanes and trails. We encourage passage of HF32, which classifies e-bikes to the national industry standard, which has been adopted by most states. This bill will catch up regulation to the reality of the usage and evolution of bicycles. Thank you to Representative Elkins, Acom, and Bernardi for authoring this bill. We're also an advocate for further funding of bicycle programs and education through transportation committees, such as Bike Education Trailer we have funded with Bike Minnesota to introduce and educate cycling with a focus on economically and diverse communities. Thanks for your support of cycling and inclusion of cycling infrastructure and education in your funding plans. Cycling is transportation. It creates economic activity, creates jobs and wellness in our state, and is worthy of continued and enhanced investment. Thank you for cycling. Thank you for riding in the AIDS ride. And well, we look forward to a great, great year of cycling and using the trails and resources in our community.
Thank you so much, Mr. Southwold. And let me scan. We have a couple of questions. Let's start with Representative Petersburg, and then we'll have Representative Mason. Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this question is for Mr. Schroer, who I think the first time I met you was on our trip down to Atlanta to that conference. So I nice to see you again. My question is always in regards to when I see comparisons, and I noticed that you compared earlier in your presentation three different things, a new construction, repair, and transit. My question is, could you define for me and tell me all that's included in the dollars spent on transit?
Thanks, Mr. Chair, and thanks, Mr. Representative Petersburg, and I have fond memories of our trip to Atlanta together, so thanks for remembering that. Yeah. I was trying to speak at a high level, and your question is an excellent one. Transit includes, there's new transit construction, of course, then there's transit maintenance, and there's what I didn't talk about, but was also called out in statistics are the things that Eric the Bike Man talked about, right, making trails and those kinds of things. Within transit, one saw the same pattern that one sees in roads, that brand new transit, which requires buying land for a new transit maintenance, produces more jobs. So you see the same difference there that you see in roads.
Representative Petersburg, a follow-up?
In fact, transit.
Yeah.
Sorry, Mr. Schroer, you're breaking up a little. You know, I am the last person to give anybody tech advice, but I have heard that sometimes if you turn your video off, you might get a little more bandwidth. I have no idea what I'm talking about, but that might be better. So thanks. Mr. Schroer, did you want to conclude? Did you have anything else? And I believe Representative Petersburg will have a follow-up for you.
No, thanks for the tech advice, and I'm happy to hear the follow-up.
Okay, Representative Petersburg.
Yeah, thank you. I did have a follow-up. I just wanted to make sure that it didn't include the actual transit drivers and the people involved with actually providing the service, because we do know that transit, when you build new transit, we're talking about 10 times or more than actual road construction, and so that makes a big difference. I'm sorry,
Mr. Schroer, maybe we could see your face again. Mr. Schroer, I'm sorry. Maybe our best bet here would be for you to offline answer that question with Representative Petersburg, or quickly, we don't really have a chat function, so we can't really do it in real time publicly here. Do you want to give it one more shot, Mr. Schroer, in terms of reconnecting? Maybe we lost him here for a second. Sorry about that,
Mr. Chair. I can take it offline with him later.
Okay. He might just be trying to reconnect here. Sometimes I've noticed that works. Sometimes you log off, log on. The challenges of the Zoom era. Representative Mason.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
There you go. Well, great to see you back. Representative Mason, then we'll get back to your answer, Mr. Schroer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is for Mr. Tronvet. I know that there are many strategies that are being used by companies in the northern portion of our state to accommodate the workers that you need. But I'd like to confirm one thing. When you're trying to get more people to come to that area, are you dealing with a stable population and just trying to get more people coming there? Or is it a matter of that area is losing population and you're trying to accommodate that as well?
Thank you,
Tronvet. Yeah.
Excuse me, Chair Hornstein, I should let you go first. Yeah, thank you. I will answer that, Representative Mason. We do not have a very dense labor market in terms of the number of candidates per opening. In my experience in manufacturing, you want to have 10 to 15 applicants for every opening that you have in your plant. We have in Roseau County, and these are Minnesota or U.S. Federal or state statistics, we have for manufacturing jobs, we have one candidate for every job that's open between Polaris, Marvin, Central Boiler, and some of the companies that are here. So it's a very thin labor market. So what we want to do is try to, encourage folks to move. We're good with in-state moves. I've been working with the Minnesota Department of Employment and Economic Development and their commissioner to try to do some creative programming to encourage the other state job service offices to ask folks to move to Warroad area, Roseau area, and take advantage of our hiring incentives. It's a tough go, but it's really more of a thin labor market. We may have lost population. I'm not sure about that, but I know that there's full employment here, and that's a good thing, but it also creates challenges for companies like Marmon.
Okay.
Thank you
so much.
Thank you. Mr. Schroer, are you, you're back with us, and it would be nice, maybe we could just do a quick instant replay here of Representative Petersburg. He had a follow-up question. I think you were in the middle of answering it, Mr. Schroer. So maybe we can take up where you left off.
Sure. Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. And let me-
Sounding quickly... great right now. Sounding great.
Okay, very good. So Within transit, you see the same pattern as you see with roads, that repair produces more jobs and more different kinds of jobs than construction. And then to his follow-up question, no, it does not include the operators of the transit subsequently after it's been built. It's just the construction.
Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just think that somewhat makes sense, because when you're dealing with the repair of a roadbed for roads, there's so much more material cost compared to labor versus a rail or others in which you're just fixing various things. And so that kind of makes some sense to me anyway. So, but thank you. Thank you for the follow-up.
Thank you, Representative Petersburg. And thank you, Mr. Schroer, for your patience and for reconnecting. Representative Cagle.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this question is to Mr. Tronvet. I'm sorry if I butchered your name. You kind of piqued my interest here. Maybe this is more of a jobs or the deed committee conversation, but was just kind of curious what kind of outreach you have been doing for those positions, and if you've thought of any kind of equity provisions or, really trying to get into different communities that maybe don't live so much in Roseau. And then I also was curious about, my husband actually works for a window dealer and has taken the Marvin plane up to the airport and said it was pretty exciting as far as that airport goes. And so as transportation goes, I don't know how useful that airport is for moving product. So I was just kind of curious on that as well.
Yeah, I can't speak. Thank you. Chair Hornstein, can I answer that?
Yes, go ahead, please, Mr. Tronvet.
I don't want to get out of order here, so.
you really, he's a veteran of the legislature here.
Yes, thank you, Ms. Kogel. I the airport is a fantastic airport here. It's right on the international border. We have four very active Marvin airplanes that fly during non-COVID times. We fly every morning. We actually serve the community. We allow folks for a free will offering, kind of like in church, when they pass the plate, folks can jump on our plane and get to the Twin Cities. Particularly, we like to help with needs that are out there, like, Mayo Clinic or U of M medical needs and things like that. But we've actually, during COVID time, spoken very seriously about transferring folks from other plants using our flights. But we're so concerned and wanting to keep everyone safe that it's pretty close quarters in those airplanes. So we haven't done that. That's why buses right now for us doesn't work. But we are putting very attractive bonuses out there for employees who work in our Grafton and Fargo facilities to come to Warroad for a period of time. We pay bonus money. We pay for their hotel and meals. And it's really creating kind of an esprit de corps among our people as they're helping us with our backlog and our orders here in Warroad. But yes, we've tried geofencing, social media. We've had on-site hiring fairs. We've put out tremendous incentives. We've raised our hiring start wage to $16 an hour, and there will be more increases coming. And we've really worked at retention too, trying to get there's a front door and the back door to every plant. And if we can kind of keep the back door managed better and get we have pretty decent low attrition, but we want to keep that lower too. We've also, every year we hire Canadian workers through a special visa permit program from Southern Manitoba and Ontario to come in. So I think we've got eight to 10 work streams that are active all the time. And it's a real problem for us, but it's a real challenge in a real high employment economy.
Did you have a follow-up, Representative Cagle?
Yes, Mr. Chair. I was just thinking, maybe we can connect offline and take this over to the Jobs Committee too, or the Deed Committee, whatever it's called now.
Representative Neuer's Committee. We have time for one more question, members. Let me just scan our participant list. I don't see any. With that, just I wanted to thank everybody for our panel. I thought it was really enriching and so many different perspectives shared today. We're looking forward to sort of continuing our discussion about investments and infrastructure for the first half of our hearing on Thursday. We'll be hearing about MnDOT's latest report on the state of our infrastructure. And a return engagement from the Winona County Engineer. Many of you met him when we were in Winona at the mini session. And so he'll be coming back along with some other local officials. And we'll start to get into a discussion about the small cities' needs. And then we'll hear our first bill from Representative Daphne next on this coming Thursday. So with that, members, thank you very, very much. Thank you for our panel and for all of your questions. And with that, this meeting of the Transportation Committee is adjourned.